Good morning and welcome to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM in Irvine. We're broadcasting from the University of California, Irvine campus, and we're on the web at kuci.org. At College Radio, actually. On iTunes, the College Radio. Today's Wednesday, May 9th, 2018. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and my guest today for the entire hour is novelist Lisa C. But before we bring her on, we are in the midst of a fun drive, and Marie Stone is in the studio with me. We want to talk about what we hope happens during this hour and what's going on.
I hope I'm never off the phone. I hope I'm on the phone for the whole hour.
I know. Wouldn't it be nice if it just rings and rings?
But yeah, 20 years.
20 years. The show's been on for 20 years. And every year when we do a fund drive, a lot of you donate and help keep us on the air, actually, because it's a strictly volunteer effort on my part and Marie's part. And for the last, well, Marie, 10 years, and I've been on for 20 years.
11 and a half.
11 and a half. 11 and a half?
2007,
I'm losing track.
Isn't it crazy?
It's crazy.
Time go.
The number here is 949-824-5824. Marie is going to be answering the phone, and anything you donate is a benefit. We have premiums. We have bookstore premiums, Laguna Beach Books in Laguna Beach. We have two $25 gift certificates. Lido Village Bookshop in Newport Beach. Two more $25 gift certificates, and for a $50 donation, you will get a $25 gift certificate. And if you're not nearby, you can go online and order from their websites.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And a tax write-off.
Yeah.
But any amount is good.
Any amount is good.
We have cool t-shirts and coffee mugs and thumb drives and KUCI swag. A lot of good stuff.
All kinds of good stuff. And even, you know, if you're thinking you've been donating to everything and it's relentless, every place and everyone you need to donate to, even $5 works. I don't know that we can send you anything, but we will send you our thanks and virtual hugs and all sorts of things.
Independent radio, free speech.
That's right.
Good things to support.
It's the only way we can keep it on the air. So 949-824-5824. And Marie is going to be sitting by the phones and hoping they ring.
Call me.
Thanks, Marie. Yep. So today we have Lisa C. with us. Lisa is the New York Times bestselling author of T-Girl of Hummingbird Lane, which is going to be our focus today, but Snowflower and the Secret Fan, Peony in Love, Shanghai Girls, China Dolls, and Dreams of Joy, which debuted at number one. She's also the author of On Gold Mountain, which tells the story of her Chinese-American family's settlement in L.A. Lisa C. was honored as National Woman of the Year by the Organization of Chinese-American Women in 2001 and was the recipient of the Chinese-American Museum's History Makers Award in fall of 2003. Her website is lisac.com. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Great to have you on.
Yeah, it's great to be back.
Yeah. You know, I should tell our listeners that you were on my panel at the LA Times Festival of Books a few weeks ago, and we talked about the T-Girl of Hummingbird Lane. And if you out there were in the audience, some of what we talk about may be a little repetitive, but hopefully interesting nonetheless. So let's begin by listening to you talk about the genesis of the T-Girl of Hummingbird Lane.
So why don't I just give just a sentence or two about what it's about so listeners can follow along. There's a young woman who gives birth to a baby high on a mountaintop in Yunnan province in China, has to abandon that baby, and then the baby's adopted by a family here in Southern California. So, you know, how did this come about? The book begins with an Akka ethnic minority saying that says, "No coincidence, no story." And, you know, that certainly plays out thematically throughout the novel. But it also played out for me as I was writing it. I had one coincidence, you know, moment of fate, destiny, serendipity, happenstance that led me step by step to this particular story. And the first of those was I was going to the movies with my husband in Santa Monica, and we were crossing the street, and I saw up ahead of us this older white couple walking with their adopted teenage Chinese daughter between them. She had her hair up in a ponytail, and it was swishing back and forth, and I had this vision of her as being kind of like a fox spirit in that family. And, in Chinese tradition, fox spirits can be kind of naughty, They can be pretty mischievous, but in their best moments, they have this ability to bring great love and to create families. And so when I saw this tail swishing back and forth, I thought, well, yes, you know, she really is like a fox spirit in that family, in the sense that through her presence, she brought great love and had created a family. And so although I'd been thinking about writing about the one-child policy and adoption from China for something like 20 years, it was in that moment that I had my way into the story. And, you know, by the time I got to the other sidewalk, I knew what the next book was going to be and really what my way in was. And so actually, for a long time, the book was going to be called The Fox Spirit of Hummingbird Lane, although, you know, fox spirits are very specifically Chinese. And I ended up writing about the Aka, and they don't have a fox spirit. So I could only carry the fox spirit in my heart.
So then how did the aspect of tea, of the puer tea, come into it?
Again, this was another one of those things that I really feel was luck or destiny. I was giving a talk at a library down by San Diego. And this was a huge event. And it was so big, in fact, that they'd invited someone to be kind of like the opening act for me. And so he was going to do this Chinese tea demonstration up on stage. I would sit at the table with him. You know, he'd pour tea for me. I'd drink it. 600 people would watch. It was kind of an odd thing, but a wonderful thing. And he was talking about tea in general, things like tea is the second most popular drink in the world after water, something I didn't know. He talked about the difference between tea shrubs and tea trees. And so tea shrubs, no matter where you go in the world, all of them have been manicured and cultivated and cloned down into that shape. So every single tea shrub is a clone. But in Yunnan, they still have the original tea trees. And so these trees are 200, you know, 400, 800, 1,000 years old. And from these trees, there's one special kind of tea called puer. And it's the only tea that actually grows in value with age. And people will drink it when it's, you know, 10, 20, 50 years old. And so he's still talking about, you know, tea, and I'm still sipping it, and the 600 people are still watching. And then he said this one thing, that just that year, so now 3 years ago, there was a single cake of puer, a little under 1 pound, that had just sold at international auction for the equivalent of $150,000.
Mm.
And when I heard that, you know, I knew what my historic backdrop was going to be. And, you know, it's interesting because, you know, when you hear something like that, your story can go in a lot of different directions. You know, if there's something that valuable, you can write a mystery or a thriller. You know, let's say there was a cave that had 50 tea cakes like that. Well, all of a sudden, that's a huge amount of money. So, you know, it was interesting to sort of take that idea of something that valuable that people really don't know about and then wrap it into this other story that I had wanted to tell about adoption.
Hmm. Yeah, I'd never heard of the tea, and of course I'm reading your novel and I'm thinking that it's fictional, right? And then I go online and I see all this stuff about this tea, and it was really, really interesting to know, and then I started thinking about even those of us who drink, you know, Earl Grey every morning or whatever we drink, and do we ever really think about sort of the history of tea? I mean, we know a lot about coffee, but we don't really think about tea.
Right, or if we do, maybe, you know, the Boston Tea Party is
right,
as far as we've gotten.
Oh, and then, you know, the story, it's so heartrending. I mean, early on in the book, I don't think this is a spoiler, early on in a moment of hopelessness, Lian leaves her baby on the steps of a home, of a shelter. And when she goes back for her a little while later, the baby has been adopted.
Mm-hmm.
That was so incredibly heartrending. How did that come into the story?
The part that she came back or the part that the...
All of it, actually, because it seemed like that started then another thread that wove through the novel of, you know, we then later meet Haley, who is a baby and being, she's adopted and well, I don't want to give it away. But.
Well, I think, you know, I wanted Leon and the person who did become her husband, she was unmarried when she gave birth, I wanted them to have a chance to go back and get the baby. You know, that they think that they're going to be able to sort of surmount this thing that happened, that she had to give away the baby because he was away and they weren't married. But, you know, because I thought that that said a lot about both of their characters, and the fact that the baby is no longer there has this ongoing effect for both of them, certainly for Leon, who's lost her daughter, but it also has some kind of surprising ramifications for the father. So there was that, and I really felt it was important for readers to feel that these people had actually really wanted their daughter. And in real life, you know, circumstances of the one-child policy, people aren't just leaving their babies, you know, hither, thither, and yon for fun. They're doing it because of the circumstances of their lives and because of the government. And it's not an easy choice, and yet for many of them, it's their only choice. But that doesn't mean that they don't have, you know, emotions and feelings about it. I think sometimes we get the wrong, here, that we get the wrong idea of what a mother or parents might go through emotionally when they would have to abandon a child.
Hmm. Yeah. And, you know, you mentioned the couple and marriage. Marriage is important in this Akha culture. Yet it's interesting that premarital sex is encouraged.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. They have this tradition, two things. One is called the flower room, and it's a building in the village where young people can go, and I guess you would just sort of, in our lingo, say make out, you know. But you can also go out into the jungle and steal love. And I think it's important to note, though, that this is just a short period of time. So the Akha have something called the Swing Festival every year, and you know, all the young women who are now of marriageable age finally put on their really beautiful headdresses that they've been working on for years. The young men from neighboring villages come to check out these young women. And then you have about 3 months of fooling around. But at the end of those 3 months, you're supposed to get married.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you can kind of squeak by maybe in that 3 months. But, you know, certainly there are a lot of married couples who have babies sooner than 9 months after marriage.
Hmm. Interesting.
But yeah. I think that their thinking behind it is one that many of us would agree to, which is if that aspect of your life isn't working or is disagreeable, that's probably not the person you should marry.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI FM in Irvine. We're in the midst of a fund drive, if you just tuned in, and any donation is appreciated. We have books as premiums for a $25 donation. We have Lisa C's, The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, that I will send to someone who wants it for a donation. And there are other new advanced reader copies of releases that of books that from authors who've been on the show or who are going to be on the show that you can choose from too. 949-824-5824. Marie Stone is waiting for your call. I know I saw the phone ring, which is a very happy thing on a day like this. So keep her busy out there. And back to Lisa C. So in The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, the protagonist's story is told in the first-person present tense. How did you decide on that?
You know, all of my historical novels have been written that way.
Mm-hmm.
And I know a lot of writers find the first person very difficult. And there are some problems, you know, with it, because you only have one point of view, right? And you have, you know, and there is this thing of the unreliable narrator. What I love about the first person is that you are completely with that person and inside that person, so that you can experience their emotions in a very true way, or at least I think so. And it helps me, too, to just be in that character. As far as being in the present tense, one of the things about Chinese, and of course they're speaking Akka, the Akka language, but it is related. I mean, it is its own unique language, but it does have some similarities to Chinese, which is Chinese, there are no verb tenses. It's all in the present. And the only thing that changes it are words like yesterday, you know, 10,000 years from now, those time words, but the verbs themselves just stay in the present. And so that's just one of the ways that I try to kind of honor the language, even though I'm not trying to do a dialect or make it, you know, sound, I don't know, corny, if you know what I mean.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I love the first person. And as I was reading, because I'm always kind of studying sort of what is the writer doing here, as I was reading, I was thinking there could be no other way, because the first person allows us to get so far in, so deeply within Leanne and, you know, her psyche and what she's going through and what she's dealing with, that, you know, it was interesting that you did this, and I love that you did this. And then Haley comes in, the daughter character comes in, first more at a distance, and then the older she grows, the closer we get into her point of view. Talk about bringing in Haley.
Yeah, can I just say one other thing about Leanne, though, before I talk about Haley, which is this is a very different culture, you know, and it's not, and again, it's not Chinese culture, it's the Akka culture, and there are things that are going to seem very foreign to readers. I mean, that's what I felt, you know, things like their beliefs about human rejects, what they called human rejects, or some of the things that have to do with the sort of spiritual leader and the medical leader of the community, and how she responds. She's like the bridge between our culture, you know, the readers, people who are reading the book, and her own culture, so that she can react to some of those things maybe like we would. And that I felt like that was a way for people to actually go deeper into the Akka culture.
Yeah, and before we get to Haley, so talk a little bit about the human rejects, because that was kind of shocking. And I, you know, I've known about the one child policy in China, but this culture with the idea that twins are not a good thing. Can you talk about that?
Right. Well, so until about 23 years ago, the Akka would, and I don't think this is a huge giveaway because it happens in the second chapter,
right,
but the Akka would kill twins. And they saw them as being very contrary to nature, that humans give birth to one baby and animals give birth to litters. Mm. And so that they would see this as just out of alignment with nature, and that these children were, you know, human rejects. And there were other categories of human rejects, babies who were born out of wedlock, babies who were born with certain kinds of disabilities. And I should say that actually the world cultures kind of divide up pretty evenly. About half of cultures have looked at twins as a blessing. Often they're twins who are founders of the culture, founders of the society. But the other half have really looked at twins not in a good way, you know, that this is a potential disaster coming. And you know, we have to remember that even in our country, medical care has changed dramatically for mothers of twins and the twins themselves just in the last 30 years. And so, you know, partly it was just this is a disaster that's coming, and it's a tragedy that's coming, that perhaps the mother won't survive, perhaps those twins won't survive. But then there was also this kind of practical aspect, which was, you know, especially in very poor societies, do we have the resources to take care of two?
Mm.
And do we have the resources to take care of someone who might not be well or be able to fend for his or herself?
Mm-hmm.
So all of those things sort of tie together for why the Akka believed the way that they did.
And they're so superstitious about so much. I mean, they're looking for omens and everything. And I don't know, I think there was a section somewhere about them studying a part of an animal, the liver or something,
right.
to you know, detect omens, good omens, mm-hmm. bad omens, whatever.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
It's wild. Wild. How much research did you have to do?
The book took 2 years, but I feel like in some ways maybe it was more like 20 because mm-hmm. I was thinking about this for a long time. But once I decided this is the book that I'm going to write, it's about 2 years, and I'll say that I'm editing all the way to the doing research all the way to the very, very end.
Mm-hmm.
Because even, you know, even when I start actually writing, I think I've done everything that I need. But then as you go along, you realize, oh, I need to know about real estate prices in Pasadena in 2008. I mean, you know, these sort of odd
right.
things that come out. What kind of visa would people have? What was the popular toy for girl or, you know, collectible thing for girls in seventh grade in the San Gabriel Valley?
Mm-hmm.
Where would people go if you were a teenager to hang out if you're in the San Gabriel Valley in a particular year? So those things are continuing all the way along. And with this book, I remember all the way into copy editing. So the book is completely done. All the editing has been done, but now the copy editor comes in. And she had a question at one point. It's Haley, and I'm going to say something like fifth grade, has written a very short report about the Boston Tea Party. And the assignment is, you know, write about something that happened during the Revolutionary War, but also what kind of an effect has it had on you and your family right now today. So in it, I'm going to just make up some numbers. I said, you know, she writes something like, and during the Boston Tea Party, 325 cases of tea were dumped in Boston Harbor. And the copy editor wrote to me and said, well, I just looked this up, and it's actually 417 cases. I dropped everything and spent about 40 hours looking up all of these other sources to find out how many cases of tea were dumped in Boston Harbor.
Hmm.
And it turned out that every single source had a different number.
Hmm.
And then the copy editor and I had a whole conversation about, well, which is the source we're going to go with and why?
Mm-hmm.
And I think we ended up with, you know, a professor at Harvard who, you know, I think people feel is the expert.
But yes.
His number is, I don't know if that's any more reliable than somebody else's. It was just we finally made a choice that he was the one.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, we're going to take a really short break, and when we come back, we'll have more Lisa C., and we will get to talking about the Haley character when we come back. So please stay with us. Don't go anywhere.
Such a long, long time. Look like I get you off of my mind, but I can't. Just the thought of you turns my whole world misty blue. Oh, turns the flicker to a flame. Listen to me, good baby. I think of the things we used to do, and my whole world turns misty blue. Heaven knows I've tried. Oh, I've tried. Baby, when I say that I'm glad we're through.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on 88.9 KUCI FM, broadcasting from the University of California Irvine campus on the web at kuci.org and iTunes at College Radio. I'm Barbara DeMarco Barrett, and we've been here with Lisa C., and we're going to bring her back on in just another minute or two. But first, I must talk about the fund drive that is going on right now through next week. Every year we do this. We used to do it 2 times a year. We've gone to 1 time a year because we know how much you all love fund drives, right? So we do, though, need you to know that to keep KUCI on the air, we rely on donations. And if you listen to the show or listen to anything on KUCI and you find benefit in that, we hope that you call 824-5824, that's the 949 area code, and talk with Marie, who is sitting by the phone, and make a donation of some sort. We have, for $50 donations, we have gift certificates to Laguna Beach Books, and we have one left for Lido Village Books. We have advanced review copies, Lisa C.'s The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane novel, and other premiums that you can choose from. And I want to thank P.J. Colando and Cindy Cooksey for calling and making wonderful donations. These are tax deductible, and again, we rely on you to help us out here. It's been 20 years that we've been on the air, which is unbelievable, really. And we'd like to make it a few more. And so 949-824-5824, Marie Stone, who will be here next week with Claire Fuller and someone else, another wonderful author, is out there by the phone. So keep her company, make a call, and please think to donate. And if you're listening to the show after it's been on the air live, you can go to the KUCI.org website and donate there. Just please indicate that you're donating in the name of Writers on Writing. Let's bring Lisa back on. Hey there.
Hi. Can I just say something?
Of course.
About, you know, I didn't know you were going to be doing the fundraiser when I was on with you, but
yeah.
I'm so glad that we are. And I just hope that the people who are listening, you know, this is such a great place, your show, for writers to talk about their work. I've learned so much listening to your show. It's just so great. And you know, there are very few places anywhere now in the country where writers can talk about their work. And so what you're doing is so important. And, of course, you know, public radio altogether right now is very important for us to get really good news but also really great music. So thank you for what you're doing, and I really do hope that the people who are listening now will call in.
Oh, thank you, Lisa. Yeah, public radio. I mean, you know, public radio tends not to be at all dependent on any sort of sponsorship or you know, we're not censored. You know, we can talk about what we want to talk about. We maybe cannot use the 7 dirty words that George Carlin made famous, but that's about all we can't do, you know. And I love that there's still public radio, and I love podcasts too, you know, shows that go direct to podcasts. But there's something about radio that just adds another element to talks like ours. So thank you.
Welcome.
So let's go back to Haley, the character of Haley, the baby that Leanne leaves on the steps of the shelter.
Yeah, so actually, when I was first plotting out the book, I had a whole story for Haley, huge story for Haley with her, you know, adoptive mother and grandmother, this kind of three-generational thing. Well, I got about 100 pages into the novel, and I realized, if I keep going like this, this is going to be an 800-page book. And there was a point, actually, where we talked about, could this be two or even three books? But I really wanted it to be just one full, complete story. And so I put that whole, you know, this whole big plot aside, and I really had to think for quite a long while about how I would tell her story. It really, and it took me a long time before I really figured it out. And so I don't know that many people know this, but I've curated some museum exhibitions. And while they have had fine art in them, they also have had a lot of ephemera. Maps, letters, diaries, Christmas cards, you know, all kinds of other things. This kind of paper trail that all of us leave behind. And once I thought of that, of how I had done that in museum shows, I thought, this is what I could do for Haley. Because at the beginning, of course, she can't speak for herself. She's just a baby. And so you would see her, again, through this paper trail. So the report that the woman who runs the orphanage writes, letters between her doctors who take care of her when she first arrives in the United States. She arrives quite ill. Emails between her adoptive mother and grandmother, until finally you start to hear Haley in her own voice, although she's still just a little kid. So there's a Mother's Day card to her mother, and spelling sentences she writes in third grade, and that Boston Tea Party report from fifth grade, until finally you really start to hear her more as a full person, not a little kid. And I guess this isn't her last chapter, but it is my favorite chapter, which is a transcript of a group therapy session for teenage girls who've been adopted from China.
Hmm. Yeah. That brings up so much. But, you know, I'm curious, because this novel is so based on this culture and an era, how much latitude do you have to fictionalize, or did you feel you had to fictionalize?
You mean for the Aka people?
Yeah.
Oh, I really, the story is fiction, mm-hmm. is made up, but everything is based on fact. I feel like if your book is going to be labeled a historical novel, it better be accurate.
Mm-hmm.
And I know when I've done some reviewing of books, and if I see a mistake, then everything else is called into question for me. So I think I sort of approach it as a reader first, that if I see anything that's wrong, then the author has lost me entirely. So, you know, everything about the Aka is accurate. Everything about T is accurate. I interviewed all these, you know, young women around the country who'd been adopted from China. I interviewed parents of young women who'd been adopted from China. I really feel that those are the things that ground the story, because a lot of what happens feels so almost far-fetched. I mean, the beginning of the novel starts in 1988. I can't tell you how many people have said to me, I've had to go back to that front page that said 1988 because it feels like it's 100 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
One woman just the other day said to me, I thought it was taking place in the year 800. And I was like, well, it's not 800. You know, it's 1988. And because the culture, let me put it another way. We think of China as being a global economic superpower. And, of course, it is. But you don't have to get too far out of a big city before you do start to step back in time. 50, 100 years. And in this area, in the Ti Mountains of Yunnan, you know, they only got electricity 13 years ago. So that means that before that, they were really cut off from the rest, you know, not only China, but the rest of the world.
Well, you know, there seems to be no end to the stories that you come up with about China or take place in China. And I'm curious if when you're working on a novel, are the seeds for a subsequent novel taking root, or do you need to be completely through with the book you're working on before you can even think of the next one?
I have to be completely done. I mean, that's just, I don't think I have enough room in my head. But that doesn't mean that I'm not thinking about things or that I haven't been sort of collecting things over the years. I tend to think about a story 4 years before I decide that's the one. And a lot of that has to do, again, with sort of my way in. I remember with Peony and Love, for example, this is a story that's, again, based on fact. Three women in the mid-17th century in the Yangtze Delta in China who wrote the first book of its kind to be written and published anywhere in the world by women. And there's certain ways you could tell that, you know, easy ways. You tell the first woman, the second woman, the third woman, you know. But I didn't want to do that. So it took me a long time before I figured out my way in. And my way in turned out that the first of those women would die. She did die in real life. Would become a ghost who then you could stay with her throughout the rest of the story. But it took me, you know, again, probably something like 8 years before I had that thought, oh, I could just tell it all, through the whole story through her eyes, even though she's not necessarily on this living plane.
Well, 8 years, you know, and a lot of what you've been talking about makes me think of patience, that as a writer, you have to have so much patience for the process or for what you need to go through to write a certain book. And patience seems to be the one thing that many of us are lacking, right? We want it all to happen right now.
That's right. And of course, there are times, I think, when writers do have a moment of inspiration. I mean, isn't that the story of J.K. Rowling, that she was sitting in a cafe and all of a sudden, or was on a train or wherever it was, and the entire plot for all of the Harry Potter books popped into her mind? Well, I don't know if that's true, but I could see how it could happen. And one isn't the right way or the wrong way, but I do think writers, and all artists actually, have to take time to let things percolate, to let things simmer, because that's bringing us deeper into what we want to do.
Well, I'm thinking of something, and I don't know if it was your mother, the late great Carolyn C., who said this, or someone else, but the phrase is, write the story that is yours alone to write. And I'm thinking of your books, and you've written in different genres, and your most recent books all have to do with China. And I'm wondering if, when you hit on that, if you knew, here's my sweet spot, this is it, or did you see yourself writing a few books having to do with China, taking place in China, and then, you know, seeing what else was brewing?
Actually, this is a story that my mother, I don't know if she said that. It sounds like something she would have said. But I will tell you that when I was working on my first book on Gold Mountain, which is about my family, and, you know, my mother and I had collaborated on books together. We'd both been writing, you know, as freelance journalists. Of course, she had all of the novels and other books she wrote. But I do remember having a conversation with her on the phone in which I said, you can have the entire world, I just want China. So it was very deliberate at the beginning. And I want to actually, and why it was is part of why I wanted to write this particular story, which is I lived with my mother when I was growing up. Her family was very, very small. On my father's side of the family, it's this really large Chinese-American family. I think I have about 400 relatives here in Southern California.
Wow.
There are about a dozen that look like me, the majority still full Chinese, and, a little spectrum in between. So, again, although I lived with my mom, I spent a really large amount of time with my father's side of the family, particularly my grandparents. I think, my parents were married very young. They were divorced after 3 years. I think they both, they really relied on my grandparents to step up, and they did. And so, I spent a lot of time in Chinatown. I spent a lot of time with my relatives. And when I think you have to think how we identify ourselves. We identify ourselves by the people who are around us. They're our mirror. They're the ones who tell us who we are. And so when I looked around, what I saw were Chinese faces. What I experienced was Chinese culture, Chinese tradition, Chinese food, Chinese language. And so that is really the reason I write the kinds of books that I do. But, your listeners can't see me. I have red hair and freckles, so I don't look Chinese, even remotely Chinese. And so I feel like with a lot of these books, what I've been trying to do is not explain the culture to other people, but I'm really trying to learn for myself. What do I know? What do I not know? And really, at heart, sort of who am I? And I have had times in my life where I've wondered, really, what am I? Am I Chinese? Am I American? Am I Chinese American? Or am I something else? And that set of questions, that's really at the heart of why I wanted to write about adoption from China. Because I feel like in many ways, those young women have had an opposite experience to mine. Many, not all of them, but many of them have been adopted into families where they're the only Chinese face. They might be the only Chinese face in their class or their school or their church or their synagogue or even their community if you go out and, further inland into the country. And so they, too, have had, not looked like everybody around them. And they, too, have wondered, what am I? Am I Chinese? Am I American? Am I Chinese-American? Or am I something else? And that I think, has been really a solid piece for me throughout all of my writing, but was very much at the heart of why I felt I needed to write The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane.
Well, On Gold Mountain was a nonfiction book, yes? About
yes.
your Chinese-American family mm-hmm. settlement. Have you considered memoir as a form?
People ask me about that all the time. And, my mom wrote such an incredible memoir, Dreaming, Dreaming, Hard Luck and Good Times in
uh-huh.
America, I think something like that.
Yep.
And I don't know, sometimes I'll think, I'll do that when I'm a little older. Well, now guess what? I am older, so maybe I really need to start thinking about that.
That's funny. Your mom was on the show a few times, and I remember once she came on, and she started telling a story about you coming home from school as a kid, and you had this paper you wanted to write. You had to write, and I don't know if you were having trouble or, and she's like, no, I'm not helping you. You're writing it.
I don't remember that in particular, but I do remember I think it must have been fifth grade, where it's funny because we were just talking about Haley writing in fifth grade, but I had to write some kind of report about the Revolutionary War. And I asked her to read it, and she actually made a couple of comments, but she didn't point out that I'd spelled church incorrectly throughout the whole paper. And it really kind of hurt my feelings. I was like, why couldn't you have just said, like, maybe you should go look up that word? And so I was circled in red throughout, and I had it C-H-R, wait, how do you spell it? Yeah, C. However I did it, I had the R and the U backwards. And, but she helped, you know, I can't even begin to say how much she helped me as a writer, you mm-hmm. know, and she taught writing for, I'm going to, I don't know, 30, 40 years in addition to being a writer herself. But I feel, in those, you know, those writers, there's so many writers, particularly here in Southern California, who took classes from her at UCLA mm-hmm. and, you know, became writers, became editors, became journalists. And that's a real legacy that I think that she has. But I was in a different position, which was I actually had a lifelong apprenticeship.
Yeah.
And my mother's father was a writer as well, so I'm the third generation. And, I could joke around and say, well, it's a good thing they weren't plumbers. But, you know, they could have been brain surgeons. So I don't know, maybe, I don't know if it's better that I ended up a writer. But I there are things that I do that not only come from my mother, but come from her father as well.
Mm. Yeah, I'm very lucky. That's, I continue to recommend her books, and quite lucky to have her as a mom. We have a few minutes left. You're listening to Writers on Writing. I'm with Lisa C. Her book is The Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, published by Scribner. We have a fund drive going on. Marie is out there looking a little lonely. The phone number is 949-824-5824. We have books as premiums, bookstore gift certificates as premiums, and all sorts of other KUCI swag. So call and make a tax-deductible donation, or go online at kuci.org, and you can do it there. And just indicate that Writers on Writing is what you listen to. And that'll be great, too. You know, you're one of the authors, one of the only authors I know who has such an extensive marketing or energy for marketing. You know, I mean, it seems like you have a healthy email list, and you're fine with that. You're fine with doing what you need to do, which a lot of authors do hate the idea that they have to go out, or they have to let people know what they're doing and get people to come to events and all that sort of thing. Can you talk a little bit about that, and then how you keep that separate from your writing so that you're not just doing that?
That's a really great question. I think part of it really, again, comes from my mom. And, you know, she started getting published in the 1960s. To remember, in the 1960s, there weren't very many women who were being published.
Mm-hmm.
There certainly weren't very many women from Southern California who were being published. There was Joan Didion, and then she moved to New York. That was really it. So, even today, if we look at the bestseller list, there are more men on that list, and they get paid more than women. I mean, that's just, you know, I'm not complaining about it. It just is. And so my mother was really starting from zero. And she really believed you have to go everywhere, you have to do everything. And I do believe that. I remember one of the first events I did for On Gold Mountain was out in Whittier. Four people came. Do you know that those four people, they still come to events.
Mm.
And I feel it's important to have a relationship with readers. And I've learned so much from readers. So one of the things I do is I talk to a lot of book clubs on Skype. And, it's usually at the end of the day, so it's not taking anything away from my writing. For me, I like to write in the morning. I'm pretty worn out by 4 o'clock. So, you know, if you're talking to a book club on the East Coast, it's 7 o'clock for them, it's 4 o'clock here. And it's kind of a nice way for me to end the day. But I have learned so much from people in book clubs, about how people interpret books and stories in ways that certainly were not, you know, what I intended. So it makes me, I think it's made me a better writer. But I can remember with my mother, we started with a mailing list of zero, you know, and so it was this gradual thing for each of her books to sort of build this. And of course, then I started adding into that once I started writing, and that list is still with me today. It really started with my mother back in the 60s. And I just feel like it's important to have a connection to people who read your books, to care, you know, to really kind of care about them. When I started out, you know, nobody could have heard of me. And my son actually created a website for me, which was actually one of the early author websites. And it was just like something he did in high school, you know. And that's, I've been adding, you know, back then I would say, oh, I'll come and visit your book club or whatever. You know, I was lucky if I got one email a week. It was a thing, write to Lisa, maybe one email a week. Well, that I still have that same website. It's been updated over the years. But there's parts of that website that go back now something like, I don't know, 25 years. But I've always had that section, you know, write to Lisa. I'm the only one who reads it. I'm the only one who responds. I may not get back to it right away. Sometimes I do, but sometimes it can take me a couple of weeks. But I always write back because I feel like if somebody has taken the time to write to me and ask me, I was answering some this morning, actually. There was one woman who wanted some advice about writing. There was another woman who... and how she should start. She's done all her research. How should she start? There was another woman who is an invalid and had been listening to one of my books in an audio version and how that what that meant to her. How could you not want to hear from somebody like that and write back? And so there are times, it's true, there are times when I think, oh, my God, I can't believe I have to write the newsletter or whatever, you know, whatever it is. Or I can't believe, oh, my gosh, I've got 50 emails here. How am I ever going to respond to them?
Yeah.
But I feel it's really important to do that. And it's important for the people on the other end, but it's also really important for me. I mean, just me as a
right.
human being.
Right. Yeah, and you know, we were talking at the LA Times Festival about this and about your mom, and you know, that generosity was something I noticed with her.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that she was such a generous writer, and I think sometimes writers, you know, get into the headspace of, you know, I just don't have time for that. You know, I don't have time for that. And
well, but there is another thing, which is writing is very solitary. And so there's a reason, you know, there's a reason why a lot of us become writers is because we just want to be locked up in a room all day. I mean,
yeah.
We actually like that.
Right.
I like it.
I like it.
And we're, you know, most of us are not naturally social. In fact, you'd say the opposite if you want to be locked up in a room all day. So it's, you know, it's hard. It's not easy for me to go out and give talks. I think I'm better at it than I was, and I think I'll be immodest for a second and say I think I'm pretty good at it. But it's not my natural state of wanting to go out and stand and, you know, speak into a microphone.
Yeah.
It's hard for me to do that. But I think it's important to do it.
Well, it's been a great pleasure to have you on the air for this entire hour, and perhaps we could do it again when your next book comes out. That would
I
be
hope so.
Great. Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
You're welcome. Okay. That was Lisa C. Her novel that we've been talking about is the Tea Girl of Hummingbird Lane, we still have it as a premium. If you call in 949-824-5824, Marie is out there still answering phones. I'll be out there in a few minutes. I want to thank Marie Richmond for making a donation, and again, PJ Colando and Cindy Cooksey. Did I say recommendation? I mean donation. But their donations are recommendations for all of you to do the same. And you can write it off. It's a tax deduction where we can send you a letter that says you deserve a deduction. And that's it, though. That's it for today. Marie will be here next week. Thank you so much. And writers out there, stay in the chair.